Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. Larry Burris, professor of journalism, was a recent guest on this program along with his wife, Dr. Kathy Burris, from elementary and special education, to discuss their trip to Egypt, which occurred before the recent upheaval and the departure of President Hosni Mubarak. We have Larry back on the program today to discuss how the media have been covering events in the Middle East, from Tunisia to Egypt to Libya to the upheaval in Yemen to the American response, and how the media have been handling themselves throughout. American media, Arab media, British media worldwide, and taking stock of the cataclysmic events that have seemed to be happening in a domino-like fashion, but have not led to any sheer permanence as of yet, and have been overtaken to some extent by the equally catastrophic and cataclysmic events in Japan, the earthquake, the tsunami, and the nuclear crisis. It's nice to know that it took something, even though it was all that massive, to knock Charlie Sheen off the front page, Larry.
It's finally get Charlie off the front page. I'm not quite sure how much news value he has, but he was certainly there for a while.
Well, it did cause some comedians to speculate that maybe Charlie was Muammar Gaddafi's speechwriter, but
Absolutely.
It's possible. Tell me what, let's start with a general impression of international coverage of this event, because, as you know, United States news agencies have cut way, way back on their international coverage, the number of news bureaus they have in other countries, due to budgetary concerns and also due to what they consider to be, pre and post 9/11, strangely enough, a dwindling audience for international news.
I don't know that the audience has really dwindled.
That's what they say.
Right, exactly. Obviously, from all of the websites that are out there, from all the interest that people are talking about the media, there's certainly a lot of interest, I think, in international affairs. I think we're learning that there's really no such thing as international. Everything impacts what happens here. If there's a drought in Colombia, it affects the price of coffee. If there's some sort of riot in South Africa, it affects the price of cars. And if there are disturbances in the Middle East, it certainly affects the price of oil here. So we're all interconnected, and I don't know that the media have really kept up with all that. You're absolutely right. They have cut back on bureaus, and allegedly for budget cuts and lack of interest. I think what's happened is that the bean counters have gotten a hold of the news operations. What have you done for me lately? And the news just can't operate that way. You need bureaus in the major capitals just in case something happens. And when a riot breaks out or trouble starts, it's way too late to bring a staff in at that point. The staff has no concept of what's going on in the area, so you really need the staff there all the time.
You have to have boots on the ground in advance because they have to soak up the culture. They have to know the streets. They have to know the sources. They have to develop a familiarity and a comfortability with the people that they are dealing with so that they will know who will be providing credible information and agenda-driven information.
What happens, and a lot of times we're concerned about what are called coups and catastrophes, which is really all that was being covered. And I think if you have an on-the-ground staff, those people could give you other kinds of stories besides coups and catastrophes that would show how we are interrelated, that there are lots of things going on in lots of countries that I think would interest a lot of people here in the United States besides the disasters. And if the bean counters, if the accountants are concerned that a bureau in Azerbaijan is not creating enough news stories, or there's not enough news there, then let them do features about what is going on in Azerbaijan. And that would certainly be of interest to people.
Well, for example, if to take Russia, now, not that they wouldn't always have a bureau in Moscow, but a lot of people don't know that Vladimir Putin has an interest in trying to save tigers a certain kind of species of tigers from becoming extinct.
Sure, there are lots of, just with that one fact, there are lots of connections there. There are environmental concerns there. There's animal rights concerns there. There are economic concerns. There are people out there killing tigers for their pelts. There's a lot of connections there that people would be interested in.
South Sudan is just broken away from northern Sudan. Darfur managed to get a lot of attention eventually. How about placing a bureau in Juba to document this new emerging nation?
Absolutely. I seem to recall having a revolution in this country in 1776. I recall having a civil war. I don't personally recall. I remember there was a civil war here.
Ronald Reagan was there.
Exactly. In the 1800s. So we could certainly, a bureau that may not produce a story every day could certainly produce a series of stories about how events in Darfur and the Sudan, how are those similar to or different from what happened at the United States? How did the United States evolve after our revolution? How could another country evolve after theirs? And that would certainly be of value. Certainly it may not be immediate news value, but it would be something of interest to a lot of people.
So there is a significance and an importance to establishing a bureau in a state capital or an important city in a country that extends beyond just getting your people into Tripoli when Tripoli blows up and then pulling them out when things calm down.
Absolutely, because there are major capitals. Don't want to sound Anglo-centric here, but there are major capitals where major stories happen, and reporters in those areas, in those capitals, could fan out to cover the lesser known capitals. So again, you don't have to have a news story, a coup or a catastrophe every day to justify the expense. And bureaus are expensive, there's no doubt about that. But what has happened over the last 30 or 40 years is that the accountants have said, we're losing money there. These people and these bureaus aren't producing anything. News isn't entertainment. News is news, and you need to be ready and have, as you mentioned earlier, feet on the ground, boots on the ground, in case something happens.
CNN has a bureau in Nairobi, but I know their Nairobi correspondent covers things in different parts of Africa, not just in Nairobi or Kenya.
Absolutely. You obviously cannot have a bureau in every capital.
Yeah.
I understand that. But Nairobi is a major center, mm-hmm. and reporters there could then fan out and cover other areas.
So Tom Brokaw said a few years ago that we really don't need, NBC News doesn't really need a bureau in Paris, because they looked at the expense accounts and decided that they were going out to dinner and having lots of expensive wine on the budget, on the network budget, and not really producing much in the way of news. Well, the news bureaus set up, the news network set up bureaus in a lot of European capitals after the end of World War II, because it made sense vis-a-vis the Cold War. Russia was still a threat. Germany was still divided. Berlin was still divided. So you had bureaus in London and Paris and Prague and Vienna and Budapest.
All the major centers.
And so forth. Mm-hmm. So it behooves a network to reassess where they should put bureaus from time to time and where they shouldn't, right?
Part of the problem there is foreign capitals are great places to soak up the culture and the food and the wine and all the sights. And the accountants would need to say to the reporters, we are not covering expensive dinners.
Yeah.
You're there to work. And an occasional expensive dinner certainly have to cultivate sources. But to say that the reporters are splurging, well, tell them not to splurge. Tell them we're not going to cover those sorts of expenses in order to keep the bureau open.
But
certainly.
Don't kill your Paris bureau.
Absolutely.
Because
absolutely.
there's still French news to be,
sure,
to be reported.
Certainly.
Now, as far as the reporting of the series of events in the Middle East is concerned, I've been watching Al Jazeera over aljazeera.net/English because I don't speak Arabic. And I have found that, at least this is my assessment, that they have been straight down the line, that they have been even-handed, they have been comprehensive, they have been somewhat redundant, but that is the nature of a 24/7 cable news channel. There's going to be some redundancy, some repetitiveness. They have had some pre-scheduled 30-minute in-the-can programs, but they have not hesitated to break into them when breaking news was warranted, and they have been much more circumspect than American cable news networks that I have watched with regard to what they term breaking news. Breaking news is not when somebody blows his nose.
Exactly.
Breaking news is the bus blowing up in Jerusalem. That's breaking news.
Absolutely.
Have you had a chance to watch Al Jazeera, observe any tapes or YouTube videos of Al Jazeera, and have any assessment whatsoever of their performance as journalists?
They're doing a good job. You're absolutely right. They are comprehensive. They are less likely to do the person blowing their nose kind of thing. What I always come back to, though, and you had mentioned you watch Al Jazeera, my question is always, how do you know Al Jazeera is right? The way that we know that Al Jazeera or CNN or Fox is telling us the right story is that we compare sources. We compare CNN and Fox and three or four other outlets, but we don't have those outlets anymore because the bureaus are gone. So in the old days, we would have CBS, ABC, NBC, maybe CNN. We would have the New York Times, Washington Post, the BBC. We'd have all of those outlets there, and we could, in fact, compare them and figure out that the truth is going to be somewhere in the middle. Every source is going to have some kind of bias. And as long as we realize that and say, okay, how do I know that this story is true? Well, I compare it to another story. So we compare Al Jazeera and CNN with other sources as well. And it really doesn't take a lot to do that, especially these days. It's hit the mouse and, you know, it hit a link and
it's
you're somewhere
utterly
else.
Immediate.
Absolutely, absolutely. So people need to go to a variety of sources. But in many cases, the bureaus aren't there and you end up with one or two outlets, and that's just not good to have one outlet. I think you need to compare all of them.
And Al Jazeera is based in Doha, Qatar, so from a logistical and economic standpoint, it's more convenient for them to have boots on the ground in these various countries than it is for a Western journalistic entity to do so.
It may be easier, but I don't know that it's as practical, I think that's what I'm trying to say, in that anybody, a major news organization, could establish a bureau over there in Qatar, and the Times could and CNN could, so anybody could do that. And again, you would end up with different sources and different viewpoints on the news. That's what's really important, that you get the different viewpoints out there.
And it's not necessarily a truism that because someone is of a particular ethnicity that they would necessarily be able to be a better source developer than someone who is white and Eurocentric, because the BBC has had correspondents in all the major hotspots of the world for decades, and the American news networks use so many correspondents with British accents because they're the people who know the territory.
Absolutely.
They have been in country, they know the people, they know the culture, they know the politics. So you do not have to have, of course it helps if they speak Arabic, which
right.
many of them do,
right.
but you don't necessarily have to have a correspondent of Arab ethnicity to report accurately and well from an Arabic-speaking country.
When the news was held in higher esteem, reporters were held in higher esteem. And you could be from a different culture, and the people appreciated the fact that you were a reporter. Reporters were different. Reporters were seen as different. Reporters were seen as somebody who was going to tell the story. And now there's too much finance, too much economics involved. You know, we've closed down bureaus, and people started to say, well, if we're closing bureaus, the news must not be that important. Therefore, the reporter is not as important. And so there's this kind of mystique that reporters used to have that somehow we need to get back to, that reporters are different. Reporters are there to deliver the news.
We've seen that Al Jazeera and then some Western networks as well, while fighting was breaking out in Egypt and in Libya, would not give their correspondents names for fear of retaliation against them, for fear of their being hurt. And indeed, some reporters have been temporarily detained. Some have been beaten. Four New York Times journalists were just recently released from captivity in Libya. Talk a little bit about the dangers of being a foreign correspondent in a tumultuous section of the world.
What's happened is that too often now the news and reporters are seen as simply as arms of the government, whereas in past wars, reporters were seen as reporters, and there's always been dangers.
In the Cold War, they used to say that such and such an American reporter was just a CIA stooge.
Exactly. Yeah. And there are, in fact, laws in the United States prohibiting the CIA from using reporters. They're not supposed to pose as clergymen or reporters. So, again, that sort of sets the reporters apart. But there's always been danger. We, you know, Ernie Pyle being killed during World War II. We had reporters killed during Vietnam and Korea. There's always been a danger there. And that's part of the mystique of being a reporter. Reporters are on the front lines. And there is admittedly an excitement about being on the front lines where other people aren't. So there are dangers there. But what's happened is that since reporters, the news media in general, in many instances as seen as simply an arm of the government, then capturing or torturing a reporter is seen as just a regular act of war. You know, you're not attacking the reporter as reporter. You've got an agent of the government. And part of that is the fact that, again, reporters have been withdrawn from various capitals, that they're not special anymore. And reporters somehow need to get back to that idea that reporters are there to cover the news, not give this side or that side, but to tell us all the news out there. And I think that would give them, in fact, a little more protection.
Is that because the United States is unique in that we have a First Amendment, whereas protection of the press is not necessarily built into the founding documents of a lot of countries' rubrics?
That's part of it. In addition, the news in many cases is seen as a vehicle of policy, that in many countries, the reporter who's doing the right job is supporting the government. And that's not our tradition here, despite what many people on the right think, so that the reporters, again, in many foreign countries, are just an arm of the government. And if you attack that reporter, you are just attacking the evil government. And so that there's not that feeling, again, that reporters are somehow special and different.
But as I believe you've pointed out in the past, the governmental entities in sometimes totalitarian nations do not seem to realize that when you kidnap, torture, kill, detain journalist, you and make the journalist the story, you are just calling more attention to your own misdeeds.
Exactly. There's some, you know, some foreign dictatorships, I think, need some PR help. Not want to support the dictatorships, but you're absolutely right. It's just stupid to be capturing a reporter and torture them, because that then makes news in and of itself, and that, in many instances, makes more news than if a civilian, a non-media person, is captured and tortured. None of us approve of torture, certainly, but it's going to generate more news if a reporter is taken, and more bad news.
Do you think that the presence of people like Ann Garrels for NPR, Christian Amanpour for CNN and now ABC, and Lara Logan for CBS, who unfortunately was sexually assaulted, mm-hmm, on the job overseas. Do you think that the work of these women has put the lie to the stereotype that women were not tough enough to withstand the pressures of being in a war zone or a conflict zone and report well?
There have always been female reporters. There were female reporters in World War II. There were female reporters in Korea. There were reporters and photographers, news people, female, ever since the 1940s. So they've always been able to do the job. When I was getting my education, there was some thought that women couldn't be good reporters, particularly in broadcasting, because their voices were too high. And it wouldn't modulate well over the radio and television. So that, you know.
Absolutely.
And that we've certainly put the lie to that. So that there's always been this sort of split. Yes, we had the heroines or heroes, the female heroes. Mm-hmm. We had those. But at the same time, there was a feeling, well, you really can't do it. And I think over the last few years, just the names you mentioned have certainly put the lie to that. Yes, female reporters can do just as good a job as a male reporter. There really isn't a whole lot of difference.
Martha Gellhorn sneaked aboard an American naval vessel that was headed for the beaches of Normandy and landed on the beaches on D-Day along with all the military personnel, and it really hacked Ernest Hemingway off, who was either her lover or her husband at the time, I forget which, because got to cover the story up close and personal, and he didn't.
He didn't, absolutely. Yeah. So there really isn't a whole lot of difference.
Yeah. Nick Robertson, who has been reporting on these Middle East crises for CNN, complained quite bitterly this recently that Fox News had reported that he and his team had been used as human shields by being taken by Libyan government personnel to Gaddafi's compound, which was subsequently hit by a couple of cruise missiles, and a building was destroyed there, and he was quite irate about that. The thing I found interesting about that is I was watching CNN over the weekend, and one of CNN's military analysts, retired General Russell Honoré of Hurricane Katrina fame, speculated that while he praised Nick Robertson and his crew for being courageous enough to cover the story there, he speculated that that might have been exactly what the Libyan government had in mind. How often does this happen to a foreign correspondent, that they're being led around by the Libyan government because
the handlers?
Yeah, the handlers. And you know, to their credit, they know that they're being handled, but they're still trying to report with the caveat that they know that this is happening to them and that it's all being stage managed to a degree. How often does it happen that the government would actually put a foreign correspondent in harm's way and use them as a human shield, thinking that that will prevent American or European forces or opposition forces from attacking that particular area?
There's some pretty stupid governments and government leaders out there. Obviously, I don't know it would not work. It would hold off the cruise missiles until the reporters left. If your palace has been targeted and there are reporters there or children there or injured people there, they're not going to be there forever. And if the site is being targeted, then the surveillance satellites, the surveillance airplanes are going to know when those shields leave, be they reporters or children, and as soon as the shield is gone, then a missile will be fired. So unless you keep people there all the time, it's eventually going to be a target. So I don't know if to say, well, we were being used as shields, could be, but for how long would the shield be there? And it would not surprise me that foreign governments have used reporters as shields. Children, you know, there was the story that came out during Desert Storm that one of our targets had been a baby milk factory.
Right.
Well, it wasn't. But again, there's so much psychological stuff going on. And as you kind of alluded, there's what I know and you know and I know you know and you know I know you know and I know you know I know. You know, at some point, you just go insane trying to figure out who knows what here. And you just have to step back, use multiple sources and say, okay, Fox is saying this, CNN is making that. Let's think about this and see what kind of conclusion really makes sense.
And then there's the foreign correspondent who says in his head, I damn well know this is going on. The thing is, how can I prove it?
Exactly. Because so much of it is just going on in people's heads. You know, we don't know, you know, what was Gaddafi using the reporters as a human shield? Well, yes, he was, but then he was going to think this, and he'll make our side think that. But no, we're manipulating it this way. At some point, you got to step back from all that and just say, what is going on here?
Just to lend a little bit of perspective to all of this, in addition to you and your wife having visited Egypt, would you elaborate just a little bit on your own personal military record and your experiences overseas in various operations?
I was in Air Force Public Affairs for 20 years and really saw both sides of the public affairs media efforts out there. at the risk of offending all my liberal friends, we really did try to get as much news out as quickly as possible. I'm a First Amendment fanatic. If we can report it, it ought to be reported. At the same time, I also know that there are legitimate secrets, and that efforts are made, in fact, to get good information out while protecting the secrets. There have to be secrets out there. I don't know that WikiLeaks did a good job releasing their information. So I've kind of seen it from both sides. And generally speaking, public affairs types do try to get as much information out as possible.
And there was been some concern. I remember David Brinkley testifying before Congress years ago. I think it was before the first Desert Storm, probably during Desert Shield, as a matter of fact. The question was about whether reporters should be embedded. And Brinkley made the point that the Western media or the American media did not reveal any tactical secrets in advance during the Second World War. What on earth makes you think that loyal Americans, even journalists who are hungry for a great story, would divulge tactical information in advance of maneuvers that would put American servicemen and women in harm's way?
There are reporters who would do that. We saw Geraldo Rivera draw a line in the sand, maps in the sand, and say,
he's not a reporter, he's a buffoon.
given that, there are reporters who would not honor the need for security, and WikiLeaks has certainly done that. I don't know that what WikiLeaks has done is that damaging, but it gives a bad impression of what reporters do. And I think most reporters, most of the time, would say, okay, this is tactical information, we're not going to release. I remember I saw on CNN during Desert Storm, a reporter was standing in front of a map and was saying, I'm standing in front of the battle map here, and it's showing where troops are. And then the reporter said very deliberately, now, if you think I'm giving away information, I need to tell you that the really good map is upstairs under guard, and nobody's getting to that map. So what happens, again, there's a lot of mind games going on. We'll see a reporter tell about an operation, and then we'll have conservative talk radio will blast them saying, you're giving away secret information, when in fact they aren't. The stuff that is really secret, from my experience, is in fact kept secret. There's also the possibility that has happened that the government will give away what appears to be secret information in an attempt to influence the enemy to behave this way or that way. During Desert Storm again, General Schwarzkopf had leaked some information so that the Republican guards would move to one place, and then he went somewhere else. Well, the information about U.S. troops being in place A appeared to be secret. It appeared the media were leaking the information. Well, they had been told, here's where the troops are going to be, nod, nod, wink, wink, and reporters, I don't want to say went along with it, but from the reporter's standpoint, it was news that the soldiers, the troops, we're going to be a position A. Mm. And they said that. And then Saddam Hussein moved the Republican Guard to position A, and troops went somewhere else. So were the media being used? Absolutely. Certainly they were. Were they giving away secrets? No, because it really wasn't a secret, but it certainly appeared to be.
Right. In the midst of all of this, the Japan earthquake occurred, the fifth worst earthquake on record, followed by an enormous tsunami that caused incredible damage in the northeastern part of the country, and then the nuclear crisis at the Fukushima plant, which is still ongoing. When there are competing values here, competing stories, news judgments have to be made. When the two stories are of such powerful value, how does a news director decide to balance them out simultaneously? It's almost as though someone attempted to assassinate the president and vice president of the United States at the same time when they were on separate coasts. It's of that kind of magnitude.
Let me say that all news is biased. from the standpoint that the news director, the editor, has to say, this is the most important item. Only one story can be at the top of the newscast. Only one story can be on the top right of the first page. Only one sentence can be in the lead, and the news director or editor has to decide which is the most important. In the case of Japan, do we lead with the number of people killed, which is certainly tragic, or do we lead with the potential problem from the nuclear power plant? They're both important parts. I would tend to lead with the number of people killed because there's a lot of confusion over the danger from the nuclear power plant. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's releasing radiation, but we're having eminent scientists say, yes, but it's not that much radiation. Yes, no, you shouldn't be sitting on top of the nuclear power plant, but at the same time, you get this much radiation from sitting out in the sun. Read something just this morning, I think, where a physicist had said, if you want to get as much radiation as they're getting in Tokyo, go outside for 2 minutes, and you will absorb that much radiation. Read the other day that coal-fired power plants have released, I don't know how many tons of radioactive thorium and uranium from burning coal over the last number of years, and we need to have more nuclear power plants. Again, there's so much debate and discussion about it that I, as an editor, I would go with what I know to be the fact, this many people killed.
And the immediacy of developments as the stories progress along on these separate tracks has to play into the decision-making process, too, because you deflect your attention away from Japan if something new happens in the Middle East, and that goes to the top of your rundown. But it doesn't mean you ignore Japan. And then if something new happens on the Japanese front, then that development goes to the top of the rundown and the Middle East takes second place.
Exactly.
And back and forth as developments warrant.
As they happen. Again, well, just on campus here, we have a student paper and a faculty newsletter. And if there's a fire in a building, the student newspaper, Sidelines, is going to cover that story from a student perspective. The reporter from the MTSU Record is going to cover the identical event from the faculty staff perspective. And there may be two totally different leads for the same fire because there's two different audiences out there. And we have to consider who's the audience and what is the audience expecting.
And how does it help matters, pray tell, for a New York tabloid to put the word panic on the front page with an exclamation point to try to get, they have to do that to get people to read about this incredible once-in-a-lifetime event?
It attracts attention, and I don't know, and the research doesn't bear this out, that big headlines lead to more sales. Most people get their papers either delivered or they pick one up every day at the newsstand. So the big headline does attract attention, but I don't know that really leads to increased sales.
Is it journalistically responsible, or does the public just look at it and go, "Ah, that's what that rag does all the time"?
There are newspapers out there that are rags that are known to be rags, and that's what they do. That's their people. Some people like that. Then there's the New York Times. That's certainly the old gray lady. So you have that balance out there, and fortunately there are competing media. So if you want a comic book, if you want the Classics Illustrated version of the book, you can get that, or you can get the real book, and depending on what you're interested in.
So going back to the Middle East, just to wrap it all up, and I don't mean to put a tiny pink ribbon on this. It'll be overly simplistic, of course. But overall, from what you've been able to watch and read and listen to, how would you grade journalists on trying to cover this fast-developing and highly complicated situation that spans across several different nations?
If I put all the media together, right, left, center, if you put all of it together, I'd give it a B.
B.
It's good coverage, could be better. Some is horrible, some is bad, which is going to drag the average down. Others is very good, which will bring the average up. What I find fascinating about all that is that conservative media will generally say this story isn't being covered in the media, but the conservative media are covering the story. So you are getting that perspective. So when somebody says to me, you didn't hear this in the media, Yes, I did. I heard it in your media. So everybody's got the story out
it's
there.
It's almost as if they're not counting themselves as
part of the media.
Exactly,
yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Dr. Larry Burris, professor of journalism, thanks for being our guest today.
Enjoyed it.
I did too. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.